Just a couple things. Yes, I gotta go quickly because we have stuff to do and I'm going to finish tonight. Just I didn't listen to last class, but I was thinking about it, and I think when I mentioned the Chaim Grada, the dispute between the Nevardiker and the Chazon Ish, I might have mentioned that he's Yosef Yoizel Horowitz, but that's not the case. Yosef Yoizel dies in 1919, so it's not wouldn't be the case with Grada. It's another one of the there was a few different Rosh Yeshiva, and as I told you, Alan Nadler told me that he spoke to Grada, and Grada said at least that this was not referring to one individual, but it was a composite portrait. By the way, Rav Yosef Yoizel Horovitz died in 1919. There was a typhoid epidemic, and his attitude was like, I'm just going to help the people, and wasn't concerned about himself and caught it and died. It'll be interesting to know what the Chazon Ish's position would be on that, because that raises halachic issues as to whether you can put yourself in danger like that to save others. Maybe a Nevardiker doesn't think about that. He thinks just in terms of helping the others. Also, thank you to Batsala for pointing out, I read it too quickly, what I mentioned the other day about Rav Meskin. Just remember I told you the whole story about Rav Yitzchak Lapanovich going to the rabbinic conference with Rav Meir Simcha, and I said that, and he didn't eat anything because there was no yashan there, and I misread a word as meaning that when the people became rabbis, I thought it meant that they took an oath like they would not eat chadash, but no, it wasn't referring to that. It just is referring to a personal stringency upon themselves. So that was from Rabbi Meskin Sefer. And finally, I forgot to mention this for some reason. I don't know. We're talking a lot about Rav Kahaneman, and by the way, I could speak more about Rav Kahaneman, but I did want to mention this, and for some reason I didn't. Just to show you Rav Kahaneman's originality. When he created the yeshiva, he put a swimming pool in. Here's the swimming pool. He thought it was very important for the boys to go swimming. Now, as far as I know, there is no more pool at Panevezh. I haven't heard about it. And I looked online and I can't see any evidence that there is currently a pool, but there's all sorts of things about earlier years when there was a pool. And I don't know if any other yeshiva ever put in a pool. But Panevezh certainly had a pool, and Rav Kahaneman put the pool in, thinking it was important. I already told you the story that I heard from one of Joseph Kushner's daughters, that when Rabbi Teitz was, he wanted to raise money for the mikveh, so he said he wants to put a pool in. And I guess they thought swimming pool, but a mikveh has to be a pool also. Okay, everyone. Now, last class, the last thing we ended with was the altar of Slabodka's position that everyone has negios. Everyone can be influenced. Everyone. And that's, I have to say, that's the pshat and all the sugyas that deal with it. Rishonim deal with it. That's what bribery is all about. Why can I take a bribe? Not because it's gzeiras hakasuv, but because if you take a bribe, look how they explain it. The Rishonim, and I know particularly the Meiri and others, everyone basically explains that you can't take a bribe because then you'll be influenced to rule against the person. That would seem to be a davar pashut, an obvious thing. And you can cite loads and loads of examples of this. And there's Gemaras that, at least according, now see, the part of the problem is that the Chazon Ish knew all this. So we have to explain how the Chazon Ish is going to say differently in a minute. But let me just show you one Gemara, in Tainis. It talks about Tainis 14b. It's talking about decreeing fasts because there's Saras, you need rain, or all other problems. How many fasts do you decree? So it says Rabbi Yehuda decreed 13 fasts, but if the prayer is not answered, he says there should be more fasts or consider more fasts. And then the Gemara says, Rav Ami said to him, they that said, it was said to him that they said one does not trouble the community excessively, and therefore you don't impose more than 13 fasts. So Rav Ami says no more than 13 fasts. So what does the Gemara say? Amar Rabbi Abba b'Reid Rabbi Chiya bar Abba. Abba, son of Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, says Rabbi Amar, when Rabbi Ami d'Avad, Legarmei hu d'Avad. This is how they translate it in the Koran. When Rabbi Ami acted and issued his ruling, he did so on his own authority, as it went against the majority opinion. But is that what it means? The Gemara says, Rabbi Ami, who says that not to do more than 13 fasts, da'avat legarmehu da'avat. So what does legarmehu da'avat mean? Well, I open up my Gemara here and I look in Rashi. By the way, Rashi on Tainis is not really Rashi. It's another Rishon, Rav Yochum, or one of the others. What does Rashi here say? Legarmeh la'atzmo darash. Shelo amar el alafish shelo haya rotze lisanos. Rav Ami did it for himself because he didn't want to fast. So that's why he said it. So we see here you can offer another pshat, certainly, but that's Rashi here says that Rav Ami didn't want to fast. So therefore, that's why he said that one doesn't trouble the community excessively. A little strange, maybe, of the Rashash. If you look at the Rashash, he says this is a problematic statement, and it should mean, like when the word legarmei is used elsewhere, which is how they translate it here. He did so on his own authority. But that doesn't seem to be what it means here right now. Let me read you what, incidentally, I checked Sansino. Now it's so easy. I always check, I pull it up. I pull up the Koran because it's right available online. But when I saw how they translated it, I went to Sansino, and Sansino translates it as I just did in accordance with Rashi. I'm wondering, like, I have to look at Art Scroll. Art Scroll in the note will probably say that, but it raises a problem because Amunas Lachamim. So now we have Amoraim for their own well-being, their own comfort, are declaring things like this. But, you know, in my book, Changing the Immutable, I discussed a case where the Marsha says that Rav Papa did the same thing. So we have interesting cases like this. Now let me just read you what the Alter says in Or HaTzah, was it Or HaTzafon, I think it's pronounced. Was it Or HaTzafon? I'm not even sure. I think it's Or HaTzafon. The reason I mentioned, because it's Safun, the 19 letters, it's Or HaTzafon. Yeah, the 19 letters, Hirsch's work, it's written Igrot Safon. At least most people have written, described it, that's what it's written. That's the transliteration. In fact, Noah Rosenblum in his book on Hirsch has a few pages explaining why he called it Letters from the North. And he contrasts it to Hirsch, to Rambam, who has Igeret Teman, Letter from the South. But it's really not Igrot Safon. It's Igrot Safon, Letters of the Hidden One, because he wrote it under a pseudonym, anonymously. And so therefore, Rosenblum's point falls apart because of the dot in the middle of the word as opposed to the top of the word. We have a German letter where Hirsch transliterates it. So what does the Alter say? He says that the psul of Negiah is not a Gezeres HaKasuv from Chukim, of which the Torah didn't give the reason. He says, where does it come from? Yesodo b'koach psikologi hatavua b'nefesh ha'adam. He says that this is a psychological thing which is founded on people. When people get something from others, then they're inclined to them. And they can't see matters clearly. And he says, l'chor rachoshim shadvarim amurim b'anashim regili. People might think that this idea of negios only refers to regular people. Ulam medivrei chazal anu lomdim sheze pogen gam begedolei gedolim, begedolei olam. Ve'ein ish asher yachol lomar shuna kemizeh. The Alter says that negios apply to everyone, even the greatest of figures. If you take one of the gedolim and someone does him a favor, or if he has his son is applying for the rabbinate, you know, he has some interest, he's not going to be straight. He's going to be influenced by that. And I already told you that the thinking in Mussar circles is that the Mussar teachers, the Alter in particular, were very they were led to this. I find it hard to believe. I mean, this is sort of a general insight, but at least it made it more pressing that they saw what happened. Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector, he insisted that his son should take his place. And they said that the only reason he could have insisted that is because he was able to overlook the defects of his son and see him as the most qualified. And that shows you that if the great Rav Yitzchak Yochanan had negios and couldn't see clearly, then everyone has negios. Hey, doesn't think Yitzchak Avinu have negios? He couldn't see what, I don't think it's just a matter of that he's blind, but he couldn't see what Rivka could see about Esau. So what's the problem? Why was Ratzi Hirsch Rabinowitz not deserving of the rabbinate because he was anti-Musser and he wasn't fair to the Mussernicks. And so that's why they saw him as being a defective personality and someone who wasn't deserving of the Rabbonus. And and had Rav Yitzchak Hanna not had these Nagios, he also would have seen this. Again, I'm not sure if that's true, but that's how they saw it. In fact, there's another report that the Musser personalities also had this taina against Rav Chaim Brisker. It's known that Rav Chaim Brisker tried to stick Rav Moshe Soloveitchik in a certain Rabbonus, Al Kust, I think it was. And they said the same thing that, he's an anti-Musser person, so therefore the Rav Moshe, and therefore he's not the right person for it. And then he says that he just continues and says that these Negios are found even by Molachai Hashem, through Avos HaKadoshim. Even the Avos, and I think the example I gave would have been Yitzhak. I told you, what Avraham? I think you'd have to say that Avraham had Negios. Well, that's what he's referring to when it came to Yishmael, right? Avraham was willing to overlook the faults of Yishmael. Sarah has to say, point this out, and God himself has to intervene here. So, I mean, he doesn't spell it out. He simply says the Avos HaKadoshim. And, did Yaakov have Negios? Again, it's not for me to say it. He says it. But if you just look in Tanakh, I guess you'd say Yaakov had, perhaps you could say, had Negios also, his favoritism of Yosef, which set this whole problem on its way. Had he not favored, and we know why he favored Yosef. He favored Yosef because Yosef is the son of his favorite wife. So that has to be what the altar is alluding to. But if you recall, remember I told you that the altar, he tried so hard to overcome these Negios that we saw that even his own children, he didn't favor them with when it came to other yeshiva students, the students in the yeshiva. And my point was that anyone who grows up thinking that their own father doesn't favor them and maybe favors other people because they're better students in the yeshiva, that kid's not going to grow up normal. That's the only thing I can say. And maybe that's one of the problems he had with his son who left. I don't know. Far from me to say, and I shouldn't say anything like that, but I just think it's basic psychology that a father is supposed to favor their sons. And it's not so. I think there's a fine line between having negios that don't allow you to see the defects of your son versus one who's just going to favor normally. Obviously, if there's a Rabbonus, you're going to try to get your son into the Rabbonus. That's not negios. That's just simply helping your family. Tzedakah starts at home. So that's, and I think we can all appreciate what the altar said. So what is the Chazon Ish saying, though? That's where it gets really interesting. And like I said, everything that we've seen, the Chazon Ish knew. So what to say about it? Well, the Chazon Ish replies directly to the Altar of Sobotka. He even uses some of the same language. We know exactly what he's replying to. Now, the Altar of Sobotka cited various Talmudic sources. With that, the Chazon Ish, he has no issues with that. He pushes that aside. He says all these stories where you have to avoid Negios, stories from the Gemara, he says that's dealing with special tzaddikim who want to go beyond the level of the law, or maybe it's a rabbinic thing that the rabbis added, but it's not from the Torah. But let me read you what the Chazon Ish said, because it is a little striking. Again, why is there a halacha against taking bribes? Pshat is because then you won't see clearly. You'll obviously favor the one who bribes you. The Chazon Ish said as follows. The warning against taking of bribes is not one of the mishpatim. It's not one of the laws that can easily understood. We know there's a mishpat whose reason is obvious. Even if the Torah didn't mention it, we would conclude that. And then there's a chok. What does he say? He says no. He says that the commandment against taking bribes is from the chokim. This is in Emunah Bitachon, chapter 3. How could it be from the chokim? He says it is from the chukim because the Torah did not disallow a person from deciding on a halachic matter pertaining to himself. Like I said last class, we're not concerned about shochad. We're not concerned about negios because I told you could have a matter worth millions of dollars, and if you're a posek, you can decide it for yourself. Klum each other love a Pesach. You have a whole warehouse and it's $500,000. You forgot to sell it. I mean, you can come up with a head there. We don't say you're not allowed to because you have negios. You can do this. You can decide halacha for your child on every matter, unless you're sitting in a beis din. But other than that, you can decide any halachic matter you want. And the Chazon Ish says food, kashrus. There can be a case of kashrus, which can be the difference between losing a lot of money. And you can decide it. And therefore, he says, that shows you that we're not concerned about this, that we're not concerned about negios. And we're certain that the sages are above that. If you see someone who has negios, then the Chazon Ish says he's not a real tzaddik of a Torah. He's not a real Torah sage. So why is bribery forbidden? Not because of any reason we can mention. And really, the Chazon Ish, even though, like I said, the other position is the more obvious one. If we adopt the position, which is the position, I think, of every great Torah scholar who ever wrote on this before the Chazon Ish, that it's a mishpat, they then have to answer the Chazon Ish's question. How can I decide a halachic matter? Every halachic matter under the sun, even though I'm no gay b'davar. Why is that allowed? So it's a real question, and I'm not exactly sure how they would answer that. And the Chazon Ish's answer is because we're not concerned that this is simply a gzeiras hakasuv bribery. And the Chazon Ish goes on and says that you're even allowed to be a dayan of a friend or an enemy. There's only one exception, that if someone hates you so much he hasn't spoken to you in 3 days, but your friends, I could be a dayan even though my friend is on the beis din. So fine. So the other side, they can pick, that's why Zebora, he could pick someone who likes him. But the point is, if it's all about, even though I'm on the beis din and he's my friend, and that's why we each side can pick, I'm still obligated to be an honest judge and rule against my friend if that's halacha. It's not that my friend picks me and therefore I'm in his corner. That's not the way it works. But the fact is, unconsciously, as the altar said, I'm still going to be inclined to my friend. And yet we allow this. So why do we allow it? I think according to the Chazon Ish, we have to say that, you can be on a beis din of people you hate and people you love, because we're not concerned. And about and someone you really hate, why can't you be, or a relative, be a dayan? That's a gezeiras hakasuv. I think that's what it has to. That's what he says. So and he says that truth is always natural for gedolim, and we don't need to worry. So it's an unusual position, but that's what the Chazon Ish says. Yeah, I want to regarding this. I have a sefer here. It's by Dov Eliach. Dov Eliach has written a number of things about Rabbonim. Dov Eliach wrote the book on the Vilna Gaon that the Hasidim didn't like at all. Because, I mean, look, we all know there's been disputes, Hasidim and Misnagdim. Maybe we'll do a series on that. But this sort of was settled in the 19th century. Yeah, you had individuals who were in faith, didn't like Hasidim so much and Hasidus, but the great polemics are of the past, and that we've learned to live with each other. And I think most of the opponents of Hasidim recognize that Hasidus was very valuable in curbing Haskalah, and their Shomrei Torah mitzvos, and fine, they do some strange things, but we, for the non-Hasidim, we can get along with them. And even Rav Chaim of Volozhin ratcheted it down. So Dov Eliach publishes this book about 20 years ago on the Vilna Gaon, in which he brings back all these book works that the only way you'll find them today, look in Walensky's book, Hasidim U'Misnagdim. You read all the terrible things that the Misnagdim said about the Hasidim, but have been totally forgotten, and most people don't have access to them anymore, because this book is not on HebrewBooks.org. It's not on Otzer HaChachma, all the different Cheirims and everything. And here you have a whole book on the Vilna Gaon, which goes into great detail all the terrible things the Hasidim did. The Hasidim actually were very upset by this. They saw this as a very cruel act. It's interesting that they saw it as such a cruel act because he's writing a historical book, and this is part of the history. But no, they saw it as part of Rav Shach's battle against the Hasidim, the way to delegitimize Hasidus. See, in the Haredi world, when books are published, there's no such thing as just an academic book. Everything has some sort of agenda to it. So you publish a book on the Vilna Gaon, fine, but if you publish a book on the Vilna Gaon and include all this stuff against Hasidus, it's not like Betzalel Lando's book on the Vilna Gaon. You're publishing this stuff because you want people to know about it. Why do you want people to know about it? Because it's going to have practical implications. Now, it could be the practical implications are just that don't be deceived by them in thinking they're Gedolim. The real Gedolim are in our world. Remember, there's been a split in Israel between the Agudas Yisrael split. You have the non-Agudas, you have the anti-Hasidic group, and then you have the more Hasidic, the Eglah Torah. So it might be like, so when people are wondering which side they should be on in this, they shouldn't vote for Agudas Yisrael. You know, you vote for Eglah Torah or something. But there's definitely an agenda. Anytime Haredim publish something, or almost anytime, there's going to be some agenda. Because remember, they can't publish things, even if they believe it, because they'll get in trouble for that very reason. But Dov Eliyahu has published a lot more, and he published this book, Besod Siach. It's a series of Gedolim interviews, he and information from lots of different Rabbanim. I love these sort of books because often things are just thrown in there, and the pictures are amazing. So on page 256. This is all about Rav. His name was Rav Eliezer Goldschmidt. This book is all about like second level rabbis, Talmid Chachamim, figures in the Litvish world, Rashi Yeshiva, but not the names that everyone knows about. But he was on the Beis Din in Jerusalem. In fact, he's on the Beis Din that ruled against the Langer children. We're going to do the Langer dispute. He's one of the Dayanim against Rav Gorin. And he joined the Rabbanut Beis Din because of the Chazon Ish. But on page 256, he tells us that the altar of Slobodka, he had this attitude like the kings in Europe. They would have these dynastic marriages, in order to cement rulership. My daughter would marry your son, and that's a way to. The altar of Slobodka thought that as follows: he arranged marriages between Musar people and Rosh Yeshiva, who were neutral or even not inclined to Musar, as a way of to bring them close to Musar. You give them a son-in-law who's from Musar. That's what he did. And so it says here that the Chazon Ish he negated. That the altar, that was his approach. And the Chazon Ish says, and he said it numerous times, that when you look at a shidduch, you have to look at the boy and the girl to see whether they fit together. You can't have all these kashponot acherim, try to see, is this going to help Musar? That we try to, it doesn't work like that. And I found something else of interest. This point of the altar is actually mentioned in another sefer. Here you have Rav Kamenetsky, who's from Slobodka, of course. Emes LeYaakov. Rav Kamenetsky has three great sfarim. He has commentary on Gemara, but I don't know that sefer that you have to be holding, as they say in the sugya. But he has the Emes LeYaakov on Torah, which is it's such an unbelievable work. And what he knew, I don't think there was another Lithuanian gadol who knew the things he knew in terms of grammar and Masorah. So Yaakov Kamenetsky was really unique. I don't know if in his lifetime people appreciated that. And then he has two volumes on Nach. Which again, the fact that he's writing on Nach is not really the focus of people in the yeshiva of Lithuanian yeshiva, Russian yeshiva. They don't focus on this. But so in his commentary on Malachim, the book of Kings, 1 Kings, chapter 2, pasuk 28 here, or page 29 in the book, he discusses here the case of Shlomo HaMelech marrying, these other women, these foreign women. That would also be a problem. They brought their idolatry into the castle, or into Jerusalem. And he says that Shlomo understood that to build the Beis HaMikdash, He has to come to a place of peace with the nations that surround him, and therefore he married Bat Paro so that Mitzrayim could be connected to him. Okay, interesting. A lot to say about that. And then they tell you in the footnote that Rav Yaakov explained that also in the Olam HaYeshivos, Nasu Shiduchim HaHashkin Shalom, that they would do marriages in order to bring peace. And he says that in Slobodka, he doesn't mention what Rav Goldschmidt mentioned, what the Chazon Ish mentioned, to spread Mussar, to marry. He says that the altar and Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein made a shidduch there in order to bring peace between the two of them. And he also mentions another one. He says that that's how you have the shidduch between the Netziv and the Beis HaLevi. And that's the reason also there to make peace. So it's interesting, I think. Just one more point. There's another sefer I have. Where is it here? Okay, there's a sefer from a Rabbi Dovia. I'll show you a picture of him. What I'm going to show you now, I find surprising, maybe, because he's a Musar personality. Here's Rav Dovia, who was a Mashkiach and leader of the Musar movement, studied in Sobotka, in Hebron, Ponevezh. But what does he say in his sefer? He's quoted as saying, no, sorry. It's yes, in the sefer, La'avdecha Be'emes, I found this. Volume 2, page 331. He says as follows. The Chazon Ish says that that which we see, Gedolim, who very much esteem their sons, they try to get them positions, they think they're so great. Ein ze machma shehem mafrizim. This isn't because that, they're the father, and therefore they're going to exaggerate on how great they are. What does he say? But rather, they recognize who they are much better than everyone else. That's why they push them so much. Now, I just find it strange because the altar says the exact opposite. That we have to watch out for fathers because they dafka don't see clearly because of their love for their son. So, how is it that Rav Dov Yafeh, I mean, he cites the Chazon Ish without mentioning that, in our tradition, this is incorrect. I don't know. Maybe he thought it wasn't kavodik, but he mentions it. I would. He says before this, by the way, he's talking about giving shevach to people, about people, and he says that Rabbi Sarno, Yecheskel Sarno, son-in-law of Moshe Mordechai, the Rosh Shiva of Chevron Yeshiva, Chevron Sobotka, he says that the minhag ha'olam is that we praise people more than they deserve, both when they die. Hespedim, and also in their lifetime, someone comes, he's an honoree, we praise them more than we should, or more than is deserving. In other words, we say things that aren't really true about them. So how are you allowed to lie? How are you allowed to exaggerate? And Rabbi Sarna says you are allowed to exaggerate. Why? Because in general, people don't see all the milas of a person. And Mistaba, he says that every person has milas we don't see. And therefore, when I exaggerate, Mistaba, that's the way it is because there's things I don't know about. So if it's not this, it's something else. So he says you're allowed to. One other thing I'll just mention, just because it's on the page here. He says something else from the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish did not like this expression, Bli Neder. I'll get back to you, Bli Neder. I'll come see you, Bli Neder. I'll come to the event, Bli Neder. Because Chazon Ish said that, yeah, fine, there's not a neder here, but there's still a havtacha. You're not making a halachic neder, but it's still a promise. And you're not allowed to make a promise that if you don't keep a promise, that's also a problem. It's not a halachic neder, but you're breaking a promise, and that's also forbidden. So what did the Chazon Ish say? He said you're supposed to say, I hope to be able to be there. I hope to be able to do this. Instead of saying, B'li neder, I will do this. He says the Rav Yaffa said that there was a time that keeping your promises was considered an important thing. even among the non-religious. And if you make a promise, if you say I'll be there, even if you say bli neder, that was if you didn't do it, you'd be embarrassed. And his point is that today people, when they throw in the bli neder, it means they don't have to do it anymore. And that's the cosmology said it's absolutely wrong. Now, I do have a problem with the Chazon Ish for another reason. In that, in what he said, in that Brown on page 229 cites us from Sorsky, which is a Haredi, hagiography about the Chazon Ish, in which, in dealing with the Shemitah problem, the Chazon Ish was able to come up with some kulas. The Chazon Ish, of course, opposed selling the land in the sabbatical year, but he was a great backer of the Pole Agudas Yisrael, the farmer, the people who worked the land, and he tried to come up with heterim that would still work. And he came up with one heter, but then he had to backtrack on it. And he writes to them, "Ani chozer bi me heter l'kitas hashkedim." He says, "I fall back from that heter because yefshar hatir davar." And he said, "Listen to what he says: Umatzavchem hakasher hanogea elibi hishchidani latir." He says, "Because I was moved by your difficult circumstance, this bribed me, as it were. This improperly influenced me to be mekel." He says, "Avani," he says, "and I have to now be cruel, as it were, in quotes, and tell you what the law is, that we have to be strong, even though." But the Chazon Ish here says that I was so, my love for you and joy at seeing you, living on the land, that when I came to try to find a heter, I bent over too much, and I didn't do a proper job because of my love for you influenced me not to give a proper Torah halacha." The Chazon Ish, who's greater than the Chazon Ish? And the Chazon Ish acknowledges that he has negios, that his negios of loving the people on the kibbutz. This would have been, let's say, Kibbutz Chafetz Chaim, or they had another one as well, that caused him to give an improper halacha. Well, doesn't that prove the point of the altar of Sobotka? No, the Chazon Ish would say that just shows that I'm not a real gadol, but real gadolim don't have this. But I think for us standing on the outside, and we can say that when you look at the gadolim, the Chazon Ish is as great of, if not greater than all the other gadolim. That if the Chazon Ish is able to have Negios, and he acknowledges it, then Kal v'chomer all the other Gedolim, and b'chilas kavodo, well, I think we have to reject the Chazon Ish's position. Because the Chazon Ish can say, "Well, I'm not a real Gadol, and therefore I can have Negios." And we have to say, "Of course, Chazon Ish, you're the greatest of Gedolim, and you admit yourself you have Negios. And if you have Negios, then how could anyone not have Negios? At least in our generation or the past generation." So that's how I read this. Okay, let us move on. There's one other great dispute between the Chazon Ish and the Mussarniks. And although if I'm grading in quotes, I mean, it's a chutzpahdek thing, I'm not grading, but if I'm presenting a position and giving what I, let's say, and jokingly giving what I think makes more sense in this dispute, it's Dafka the Chazon Ish that makes more sense. Again, but we really need to investigate why the Chazon Ish would be so strong on something that appears to be the pshat of the Rishonim and Achronim, who've all dealt with it, that not to bribe is a mishpat. We can understand why bribery is a problem, and that anyone can be led astray. Why the Chazon Ish was so strong on that, I don't know, and I haven't seen any good explanations. One other point, by the way, in the I looked in the. I wanted to find some things about this in the great. There's a book of Maisios, of Chazon Ish, and it's called Maaseh Ish. Ish also stands for Avraham Yeshaya. That's why he wrote it, although he published it anonymously at first. I found stuff, but not really that, just repetition to what we've seen before. But I found something of interest on page, in volume 7, page 206, where the Chazon Ish said that. Again, you shouldn't focus on Musser. He says that you shouldn't you learn Musser like you learn Agadot and the Gemara, not a Seder. You don't make a Seder that say I'm going to learn an hour a day, a half hour a day. Yeah, just like when you learn Gemara, you learn through it, and then you come to the Agadic section and you do Agada. He says that that should be the same thing. He says, when you feel the need for Musar, then you learn some Musar, or you get it out of the Gemara, but you don't make a Seder. Now, I have to say, probably, that maybe you're saying, okay, that's interesting, but I don't need to go back on that. But I actually cite this only because the thing at the bottom of the page caught my interest, and I think you'll find it interesting well, he says that the Chazon Ish, for people who go swimming, the Chazon Ish permitted them to speak in learning when they're swimming, even if they don't, even without putting their hand on their head or anything like that. Because Me'ikar HaDin, when you're in the pool, you're putter. You don't need to cover your head, and therefore you can talk in learning. You know, there's no inyan, especially that you can't talk in learning if your head's uncovered. So I think people would find that interesting. And then he says, and in terms of going in the water, the Chazon Ish was very strong. You can't go to the mikveh on Shabbos, even if you don't dry yourself. And that's what the Vilna Gaon said. So I guess that'll bring us to a Misnagdic Hasidic dispute, I think, although it's possible I'm wrong. I'm not really up on the mikveh habits, because it could be that today even Misnagdim go to the mikveh. I don't know. Okay, so what's the, by the way, one other thing I want to tell you about the Chevron Yeshiva. You know, we spoke, I mentioned, you know, the altar, that he has these dynastic marriages. He wants to bring everyone together to make Shalom. He did another thing to make Shalom. You know, Chevron Yeshiva was there during the great dispute between Rav Kook and Rav Zonnenfeld, the opponents of Rav Kook. The practice in the Chevron Yeshiva was that they would buy meat from the Shechita under the Hashgacha of Rav Zonnenfeld and under the Hashgacha of Rav Kook, and they would cook it together in the kitchen of the yeshiva. To show you that we're not taking sides on this, and we have everyone. Okay. Now, the other great critique of the Chazon Ish, which, by the way, we did not have access to it until in its entirety, until the last volume, 2017. Until then, we only had snippets. We had selections found in the letters of the Chazon Ish. But we didn't know who it's response to. Brown, based on what someone pointed out to him, says it's a response from Yitzchak Sher, Rosh Yeshiva of Sobotka Yeshiva, comes from Lithuania and then from the Alter's family, and then becomes Rosh Yeshiva in Bnei Brak. But now we know for a fact. So what's the issue? Well, if you have Gnozim, the Shel Tshuvas Chazon Ish, this is not available on any online things. You have to get it on volume 5. Pages 121 and on, they reprint here two articles from the Rosh Yeshiva of Sobotka in Israel, Rav Yitzchak Sher. And what Rav Sher argues is that Klal Yisrael, when they were in Mitzrayim, don't think that they were near idolatry. You know, the Gemara says that they were at the 40, what the last level of impurity, and there's all sorts of agadas about this. He says this is an exaggeration, and there's reasons why the Gemara exaggerates. Don't assume really they were great tzaddikim, and the generation that would receive the Torah certainly was never on such a low level. But any small thing that they did, it's exaggerated. And there's a long history to this sort of argument. Doesn't the Gemara say anyone who says that David sinned with Bathsheba is wrong? Anyone who says that Reuven sinned with the concubine is wrong? What people don't often remember is that's one opinion. There's other opinions that say the opposite. In fact, the David situation, they have other opinions. I think the majority opinion is the opposite. And look at the Abarbanel and others, but that opinion is often stated as the only opinion. But this is definitely a tendency and a trend. You look in Rishonim, especially even Achronim, this idea that when they are accused of doing something wrong, it doesn't really mean. So what does it mean by Reuven? He went up to the bed. It means he removed the bed, and he put the bed from Malaya. He moved the bed out of, you know, the concubine into out of Rachel, sorry. When the bed went from Rachel to the concubine of Rachel, that he removed the bed and put it in Leah's tent. Not that he actually slept with her. I mean, so you all know these sorts of arguments. So Rav Yitzchak Sher is following a tradition. Rav Yitzchak Sher goes even further than this. He says he's not just referring to the level of the generation of Egypt. No, he goes on and he says, you look in Tanakh, and he says that, what about the generations that went into the land of Israel? You see the book of, let's say, Shoftim, where they worshipped idolatry, and they did all these terrible things in the other books of the Bible. No, he says, it doesn't really mean they did idolatry. It means that they didn't destroy the Bamot the way they should have. But chas v'shalom to think that in the days of the Malachim, I mean, what the Tanakh tells us, that they were actually worshiping idols and things like that. And he says we have to understand that to think that this is, he says, chalila, to think that they would do siyas harava, avodah zarah, kemasa agoyim asher bizmanenu, chas v'shalom, to think that that's a simplistic reading, that no, we have to read beneath the surface, that we have to understand that the great level of the earlier generations, etc., etc. That's his argument. Don't take the shot that they're doing all this. So it strikes me as a very traditional argument. I don't think, I mean, I'm not saying I would buy it, but we hear these sort of arguments all the time. The Mefarshim are always saying things like this. That I remember in yeshiva, they would say things like, their greatest sin is, you know, looking back at in the biblical figures, is like our their worst sin is like our greatest mitzvah. I mean that we can't even begin to understand their sin. So what does the Chazon Ish say though? The Chazon Ish, he says, he begins by saying that Rav Yitzchak Sher wrote that Israel in Mitzrayim, we're at the Madrega HaYoter Gedola b'Torah Mitzvot b'Emunah b'Chasidut, and then he goes. He says, "Kol HaDvarim Ein Bahem Mamash Shein Kula Neged Raboseinu Zal," and he goes on to say that this is a complete distortion of the reality and of what our sages say. And he goes on for a few pages, and it's he says that. He says that, as to Rosher says, that this generation, I will later see, you know, miracles. They could not have done this. The Chazon Ish says that's the Bechira Chofshis. And that's, you know, everyone can make such a mistake. Everyone can do that. And it's testified to it. The Gemara tells us about what the level they were at. And later, Psukim, the Chazon Ish cites a Pasuk. Here, look in Shoftim. It says in Perek Dalet, it says hold on, is that the no, he cites this for something else. It says in Shoftim, where it says that they followed other gods and the gods of the people around them. So that's not the Pasuk. Hold on a second. Let me but in general, the Chazon Ish says that he says, yes, the people came out of Egypt. They saw Nisim and Nefilos going out of Egypt and at Matan Torah. And yet, look, they made the eagle. And there was miracles in the first base of Mikdash. And the prophets did all sorts of things. And nevertheless, this did not force their free will. They avdu avodah zarah. They worshiped avodah zarah. He says they had freedom. And then what about Rav Sher continuing on, not just with the generation of Matan Torah, but the later generation? He says, take a look at the Parashios, the Chazon Ish, Devarim, Vaschanan, Ekev, etc., etc. He says that we see great hishtadlus to keep the nation from worshipping idolatry. Well, if there wasn't this taifa to worship idolatry, like you're saying, then why is the Torah so concerned about it? He says that we don't understand what idolatry is, and that there is a Yetzer Hara. He says, "Ein lanu shum musag," how they could have this Yetzer Hara, but they did. He says it's like a colorblind person can't understand colors. We can't understand what it is about Avodah Zarah, but he absolutely rejects what Rav Sher and what other in the Musar school try to minimize this. It says that
If what you're saying is true, he says to Rav Sher, then the Rishonim would have said it. The Rishonim don't say it. So here I think is the important thing. Had the Rishonim offered such an explanation, okay, but you're coming up against the whole Masorah. The Chazon Ish says, if we come to twist the Kesuvim Mefarashim, explicit psukim, all throughout Nach, that talk about them worshipping idols, if we do that, Nichrasa Amunah, then we've destroyed our faith. Because you're saying that the words on paper in Nach do not mean anything. He says, because there's no end to it. You can always, anything that the Nach says or the Torah says, you can twist it and say, it says X, it really means Y. He says, and if it was different, then the Rishonim would have explained it differently. And he says, if explicit verses in the Torah, Einan maspikot al hora'ah muchletet she'avdu avodah zarah, if these words explicitly, like here, I'll show you one of them, but there's many, but the Chazon Ish cites this one in particular in Shoftim, but they're all over the place, where it says that they forsook the God, what chapter is this? Chapter 2. They forsook the God of their fathers who brought them out of Egypt and followed other gods. They served Baal and the Ashtaroth. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against them. So according to Rav Sher, all that means is that they weren't zealous enough to try to take down any bumos that some sinners had put up, but not that the people, by and large, were worshiping idolatry. Or it could mean another sin they did that they didn't. Whoever, whatever it means, and the Torah makes it seem as if they worshiped idolatry. He says that if you're going to tell me that the psukim don't mean what they say, kvar ibeid ha'adam safato bevo saper o uvda kayemet shel avodah zarah, that basically we can't have a conversation here, because the Nach tells us explicitly they worshiped idolatry, and you say, well, it doesn't really mean they worshiped it. How can we even have a conversation? How can we talk? You're saying that the words that is written have no meaning. Nothing will help then. And you're removing from the story every its entire meaning. So the Chazon Ish is extremely strong and adamant that when the Nevi'im tell us that they worship idolatry, when you say they didn't really worship idolatry, you are totally destroying the meaning of what the prophets are telling us. And you're destroying the, you're falsifying. That's what he says. You're falsifying the text. Simple as that. Now, there was another Musar figure. It's not Rabbi Sher, because it's not in these articles. And the editors of this of his volume 5 can't identify it. But there was one who even argued that Yerovam ben Nevat, he was not really worshiping idolatry, and that's not what he was doing. And again, the Chazon Ish, very strong about this. So I think with this, we come to an end. Obviously, you have to stop sometime. There's more we could analyze. I'll probably spend a couple more classes, but we've done enough. I think we thanks, first of all, to Rabbi Yaakov Yellen for suggesting this. It never occurred to me to do this dispute, but so it's so thanks to him, I was able to learn a lot, because I mean I knew the material, but I didn't get to go into it and the way I did, because when you teach it, obviously you have to, especially a group like this, you have to really go into it. So what can I say? The appearance of my book has suffered because I spent a lot of time on this. But I'm very happy to, and less time on the book, but I'm very happy to have spent all this time on it. And I feel like I have a real handle on it. We began at the beginning, went through the different disputes, and we spoke, as always, about the various rabbinic figures. And as is our wont, we went on all sorts of tangents on every matter under the sun. And as always, I learn so much from all of your comments, the ones who are live with me, who type them in the chat box, and I'll get the chat box in a minute. And those of you who send me the emails, many of which I report to the people listening, for so many of you, the Rabbi Dov, Rabbi Yaakov, Rabbi Jay, there's two Moshes in Lakewood, by the way. And one of these Moshes in Lakewood, they try to keep him anonymous, but he's the grandson of one of the Gadol Yisrael of our generation. So, the other Moshe's an expert on Lithuanian Torah Jewry. So I think we've achieved a lot, accomplished a lot. Let me get to the questions here. And as Rabbi Kelman points out, the next series is going to start next week on Rav Moliver, the founder of really religious Zionism. I mean, we had Chov Beit Zion before that, but religious Zionism in a political sense, and one of the Gadol Yisrael. And just to show you how this story is going to be complicated, although he's really the founder of religious Zionism, Rav Chaim Brisker was a great admirer of him. And yet Rav Chaim Brisker is a great anti-Zionist. So we shall see. Mel says, is everyone selected to be on a Beis Din, a Gadol, and therefore immune to be influenced by Negios? No, Mel, I think you make a good point here. No, obviously everyone's not a Gadol who's selected on a Beis Din. But we assume that every posek, the Chazon Ish is assuming that every posek, real posek, is going to approach matters without these negios. So then my question would be what you're saying. But wait a second. But not every posek is like that, because most poskim are average and regular people. They just happen to know a lot, but they're going to have the same negios. And if you say a based in that the idea of, a bribery with a Beis Din, it's a chok, not a mishpat. Well, maybe it's a chok for Gadol Yisrael, but what about the average person? In fact, you don't need to be a Rav to be on a Beis Din. I don't have the answer to that. It's such a problematic chazon ish that one is tempted. One is tempted to say that the chazon ish is arguing in a polemical vein. He has to have another reason for this, making this claim. But I mean, it's a hard thing to say because he wrote this in a book that he himself never published. It's not like he came out with a public declaration. Sometimes in these public declarations, people say things that are maybe they exaggerate to make a point. But this is something he wrote in a private work. So I'm thinking maybe you need to distinguish between. Although he doesn't say this, but let's say bribery for Gedolim and bribery for the average person. That's right. I mean, maybe he implies this because he says that, bribery or negios, we're not concerned about the poskim, about the great figures. So why is there a commandment? It's a chok. But maybe he would agree that the commandment's a mishpat for everyone else, all the average people. But it's still usur for the tzaddik. Remember, they always say Moshe Rabbeinu can't be on a Beis Din with his brother. Why not? Moshe Rabbeinu's, we're not worried about Moshe Rabbeinu taking a bribe because it's a chok. I mean, normally we'd say because the halacha has to include everyone, even if specific circumstances it wouldn't apply. It could be, I haven't seen anyone say this, but it could be the Chazon Ish's point is only about the elites. That the elite Gadol Yisrael, why is there a prohibition against them? Now, practically, how do you determine who's an elite Gadol or not? You have to make a commandment for everyone. But maybe the Chazon Ish is really only explaining why it applies to them. That for them, it's a chok, and for us, it's a mishpat. Though I've never seen a mitzvah where for some people it's a chok, for others it's a mishpat. I can tell you, if you look online, you see discussions. In fact, on one of the Haredi websites, he says, he refers to the Shita, and he puts in parentheses, Hamuzara, the strange Shita. I don't think such a person would have written that with his own name. You know, they're all anonymous. But you see that in the Haredi world also, they're saying it's very strange. It's hard to understand. Dov says, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik's letter praising the Rav regarding Tel Aviv Rebbe in an election comes to mind. Yes. The famous letter, you know, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik would talk up his son and read that letter where he writes, and he also, I think he has a second letter, doesn't he, also to the Kovno Rav? I'm not sure. But he has the letter to the Tel Aviv rabbi, the commission to appoint a rabbi in Tel Aviv. And he says that my son is the greatest, like, of the generation. He knows Torah and secular studies. And the title of the article is Av Me'id Al Bano, because we have a klal that a father can't give testimony. And by the way, the call is, if you can't be a witness, you can't be a dayan. So normally we say a father can't testify about the son. So here, Here the father's testifying about the son. So of course you take it with a grain of salt that I told you the story, what Rabbi Leon Katz, Label Katz, told. I played the video of Rabbi Nutter Greenblatt saying this, that Nutter Greenblatt heard this from Leon Katz. This is the son of Rav Reuven Katz, Degel Reuven, but he was in America, Rabbi Leon Katz. He went to Yeshivas Rabbi Tzvi Yochanan. His father was a rabbi. Reuven Katz was here for like 3 years. He was Rabbi Bayon. He goes back to Israel, but he has sons here. He has Yechiel Michal Katz, remains Yeshiva University, Yeshivas Rabbi Tzvi Yochanan. Now, Leon Katz was the Rav of Passaic for many, many decades. And the other son, Abraham Katz, was the president of Dropsy, PhD of NYU. So he's walking. Leon Katz told the story. He's walking with Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, and Rav Moshe Soloveitchik is going on and on how great my son is, and he's the Gadol HaDor, and he knows how to learn better than everyone. So Label Katz, with a little chutzpah, says, "Was he greater than Reb Chaim?" No, after, and then Rav Moshe stops him. No, Chas V'Shalom. No one is greater than Abba, than Tantan or something. No one's greater than Reb Chaim. But okay, so he's not greater than Reb Chaim, but he's greater than everyone else. Now Dovo says the story goes that the Hasidic Rebbe notices that at Tashlich the Chassid goes down to the river to retrieve his bread pieces. The Chassid explains that the Rebbe's averos are for me mitzvos. I mean, I heard this. I wasn't a Hasidic yeshiva. I heard this sort of thing, and so I understand what Rav Yitzchak Scher was saying. And I don't, did Rav Yitzchak Scher really mean it, or was he just trying to inspire the people? I think he means it. He explains it, but Chazon Ish says this isn't just going overboard. That this is being megala punning b'Torah shelo kalacha. You're false. You're presenting what the Torah and Tanakh tells us falsely. That is a strong and harsh criticism. But I think that all of us listening, although we maybe sympathize with the Alter's approach in the first dispute, here I think we sympathize with the Chazon Ish's approach, because he's saying if we can't trust not only what the Tanakh tells us, but what all the Rishonim tell us the Tanakh is telling us, then how can we trust anything? You can't just invent a new approach in the 20th century which completely rejects everything that's been said. David says, around 5 years ago, Hebrew Theological College, Skokie Yeshiva, wanted to have a swimming pool. For some reason unknown to me, the village of Skokie refused to approve a permit. This Mordechai Kaplan's idea of the Jewish Center was to have a pool also, and the Jewish Center had a pool. It's called the Shul with the Pool. And then they sold it, or they rented it out. When I was living in Manhattan around 2000, the pool was still there, but there was a health club that was renting out. And I'm told now that I guess they've made it into apartments or whatever, but there isn't even a pool in the building. But that was part of Mordechai Kaplan's idea. You want to have a community center, and you should have everything there. But I'd love to know, for many of you who know the yeshiva history, when the Ponevezh pool was, I guess, filled in and built dormitory over or something, because I am certain. I look online and I can't find anything about it except for in the past. So I am certain there is no longer a pool. But Rav Kahaneman, if you knew who he was, a builder, an innovator in terms of ideas and of how to build, and you, it makes perfect sense. And a pool, the kids are healthy, they can get exercise, and to help bring students there. You know, Rav Kahaneman, he put up the Israeli flag. He said, if you're in Poland, you put the flag up. We're living in the, it's not a Zionism thing. As far as I can tell, it's nothing to do with Zionism. But just like when we were back in Lithuania or Poland on Independence Day, we hang the flag of Lithuania and Poland. We certainly can't treat the state of Israel as worse. If it's Independence Day, we put the flag up. And since the rule in Ponevezh was any takana that Rav Kahaneman make, you have to continue, even though Rav Shach was running the show, they still had to keep, to this day, every Yom Ha'atzmaut, the flag still goes up, even though they're much more extreme than Rav Kahaneman ever was. He never was an anti-Zionist, but an out-of-the-box person he was. So with this, we finish, and I look forward next week to picking up with all of you again a new series, Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you very much, Yasha Koach. Thank you. Thank you. I did get a request earlier, not so long ago. How can they listen to all the back talks in the series? So they are available on the website to watch, to listen. This and thousands of other talks. So please watch.
Also on YouTube. They're on
Yes,
YouTube.
that's what I'm saying, to watch. You can watch them on YouTube, which
Yeah.
you get access either on our YouTube channel or to our on the website. Tomorrow at 1 p.m., Rabbi Shulman is starting his year-long series on Sefer Yoshua, so everybody's welcome. He's a wonderful teacher of Tanakh, those who have heard him. Wednesday night, another wonderful teacher of Tanakh, Nadi Helfgott, will be starting a series on Sefer Yeshayahu, the second half of Sefer Yeshayahu. Thursday at 1 p.m., Rabbi Dr. Ari Zivotofsky, who many of you may know from his articles in Jewish Action, will be giving a talk on the definition of a Milchemet Mitzvah. That's usually interesting and current, unfortunately.
So right, Kelvin, nothing tomorrow night? You understood that people are going to, you have anything Tuesday night?
We normally do. Wait, is anything happening tomorrow? I don't know.
No, I'm just wondering, you're a Canadian, but maybe you were sensing that Americans are going to be watching that map fill in red and blue, and they're not going to.
Going on tomorrow, but those who are at the beginning, yes. We actually, that's the one night we generally don't have. We had exceptions.
Okay.
Generally, we have Monday, Wednesday, Thursday. So that's Thursday, 1 p.m. Thursday night, Rabbi Yitzhak Etshalom from L.A. will be giving the Parsha Shiur this week. And please, God, I'll be giving the Shiur on the Siddur 9:15 on the first of our early Shabbos, the Friday short day. So, anyways, be well. I hope the world's in a better place a week from now than it is today. And let's hear good things. And Davin, it should be for good, because who knows what's the best. So that's all I'll say. And
Good night.
everybody, we will. Laila Tov, and thank you very much. Okay, Rakesh, a lot of talk.
Tov.
A lot of